Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
I have a great radio voice. You're listening to 103.9 KLXR, The Arrow. Canab Splash.
I'm Dan Nalen, and this is Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug is an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, and it's one of the oldest independent publications in the United States, distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action sports, and subculture. On this episode, we go all artsy on your asses, talking to the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, the Dunst Art School, and we connect with the Salt Lake City Arts Hub. It's been about a year since the Salt Lake Art Center changed its name to the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, and since its relaunch, the 81-year-old gallery has undergone a few big changes. They've done more local art in some of its galleries, they've made a deal with Sundance and done new frontier showcases at the museum during the Sundance Film Festival. One of the biggest changes was converting the old art library into a locals-only gallery near the front entrance, featuring a new artist every month. Slug writer John Ford sat down with UMOCA's Director of Communications Danica Farley to talk about the gallery's new direction and all the new exhibitions expected this coming year.
When did the UMOCA start doing the locals only gallery?
It started last autumn. UMOCA actually went through the name change the beginning of this year, so it was the Salt Lake Art Center with the plan to move forward as the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, really showcasing, you know, the premier contemporary art here in Salt Lake City.
And what made them decide to, you know, set aside space for local artists?
Just the commitment to our local artists. We really have some phenomenal artists here working in Utah, and we wanted to make sure that they were showcased in the museum. And it's actually the first gallery space that you walk into. It's a locals-only gallery, so it's saying, hey locals, you know, we support you.
Is keeping local, you know, modern-day artists involved in the museum process important in a contemporary setting, so to speak?
Absolutely. You know, contemporary art is what's happening now. It's a movement really that started in the 1970s, you know, kind of pushing the barriers, making and new things, site-specific installations. It's sculpture, it's multimedia, it's traditional artwork, painting, drawing. It can be things that are curated from found objects. It's really a wide variety of artists and their ideas. So keeping them involved in that local scene is important to us and important to them, and we're thrilled that we have the space to be able to do that.
Now, do you feature several local artists at a time, or is it multiple pieces by one artist?
It depends, whatever the submission is. It has been particularly just one artist showcasing their artwork, but if an artist wanted to curate a show of their friends or colleagues and have, you know, a multitude of different pieces, that would be welcomed as well.
And how often are the pieces rotated out?
Three times a year. So it's roughly, you know, about 4 months each. The current show we have going will be through December 21st. And the next show will open January 1st. Submissions just closed for that. So artists can check the website, utahmoca.org, for submission guidelines as well as upcoming dates.
And for those who haven't been in, what type of space are we talking about that we have for the locals?
It's cement floors, drywall walls, so you can, you know, manipulate those walls as you need to. There's electrical power and lighting. The gallery dimensions are 18 feet wide, 20 feet deep, and the ceilings are 9.5 feet high. So it's 363 square feet. Artists are encouraged to come down and check out the space and, you know, see how they can work within that. It's really open. It's one of the five gallery spaces within the museum, located at 20 Southwest Temple, just, you know, kitty corner from Temple Square, across from Nordstrom's, off a tracks line. I mean, the location is just ideal. All of our exhibitions open with a First Friday party, the DJ, music, cash bar. Anytime that there's a new locals only exhibition, there's a big party that comes with it, which is a lot of fun because then the artists can invite all their, you know, their local supporters and friends, family. We usually get a really good crowd for that.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the First Friday events. Like, what's the next one that's coming up?
So the next one will be December 7th, and it is from 8 to 10 p.m. And that's when we have a DJ. Harry Cross Jr. will be our DJ for the upcoming one. Jesse Walker helped us out last month. He said there's a cash bar and there's a beautiful spread of food and food's free. So it's just really wanting to create this vibrant space for people to come down and see a new show. So something's opening every single month at Umoca. It's really, you know, it's a dynamic place to be. And the new show will be of the Siren in the Sky. It's curated by Triple Candy out of New York. And it's in our new genres gallery. It's going to be super interesting. So come down like First Friday and see it then, or a lot of our exhibitions take time, so you want to come back multiple times. We have a really amazing exhibition in our main gallery, which is our largest space, called Battleground States. It's definitely worth some time. So the First Friday is just, it's really, you know, great. It's got this vibe with the music going, always, you know, having a beverage is fun. The different exhibitions bring in different people, but it really highlights the best of our local arts community and people coming down to support.
Previously, what local artists have you guys featured?
Currently, we have Jason Metcalf, and he's really fantastic. His exhibition, Abracadabra, kind of around superstitions and around the world, you know, different objects, like drive a rusty nail through a lime to avoid the evil eye. So we've got this lime with a rusty nail that is just getting older and harder, and it's really cool. There's also, you know, the myth about playing record backwards. And, you know, so we've got an old record player, but anyway, just a multitude of objects. We also had Mark Hedengren, photographer, really interesting pieces about swimming holes in the American Southwest. You know, we have all of our past exhibitions on the website, so if you want more information about the artists who have displayed their work there, definitely go there, visit that, get an idea of what the work is for all the artists out there that are interested in submitting, or just the people that are art lovers. See what's, you know, available to see. And we're just really stoked to highlight the artists. And we have a lot of submissions. And artists can submit and we'll keep their submission on for the entire year. So they'll be considered for each of those three shows. And then they can go
and
again.
How do local artists go about submitting?
The website, Utah MOCA, it's utahmoca.org. Under exhibitions, there's open submissions. It has all the guidelines, all the information, you know, what UMOCA offers, a small stipend to help out, preparatorial assistance, and also, you know, being involved with the museum that's really gaining some national recognition. In the last month and a half, we've been mentioned in the New York Times twice as part of this Your Land, My Land Election 12 exhibition we're doing. So a lot of national recognition, and the artists that are in the gallery obviously will be, you know, part of that. So all of our commitment to communication, media outlets, really just the growing awareness of what UMOCA is doing. We have a relatively new curator. When the name changed, Aaron Moulton came on. He's been living in Europe for the last 10 years. Really a great visionary. He's got some amazing ideas for what's coming up. He's been with the museum since February. So he brings with him a lot of international recognition. And so we're just thrilled that UMOCA is on the map. And that it's part of this great, you know, downtown. I mean, any great city needs a contemporary art museum. And so that's what we're offering.
And if you had to give one reason for people to come down and see anything in the museum, what would it be?
You won't see art like this anywhere else. Definitely not anywhere else in this city, but anywhere else around the world. Really, it's internationally acclaimed artists that we're having, as well as, you know, our local artists that are working here that have, you know, international claim or will go on to have that. So really, it's unprecedented what's happening at the museum. And like I said, something new every single month. Whether you love the art or you love the music and the DJ or just getting out with some friends and doing, you know, this savvy activity in kind of a metropolitan style, there's something for everybody at UMOCA.
UMOCA is currently exhibiting Of the Siren in the Sky by Triple Candy in the main gallery until January 26th. Megan Geckler's No Chance to Move Backwards and See is on display until February 23rd. And Vanessa Gromek has an exhibit up from January 4th until April 20th. For more information on the gallery and upcoming exhibitions, visit them online at utahmoca.org. That's utahmoca.org. Filth Lords are a band with some deep roots right here at Slug Magazine, including junior editor Alexander Ortega and writer Rio Connolly among the three of them, along with Nick Harris. They formed about a year ago, and this month they will release their debut full-length album called Keep On Snarlin'. Here's a song called Retirement Plan off of that debut. Filth Lords will have a CD release party this Thursday at the Shred Shed, and you can also enjoy a little Eraser and Desolate on the bill. For more information on the band, search for Filth Lords on Facebook. The Dunn School for the Arts is a miniature art space and gallery focused on providing artistic classes for students of all skills and talent ranges. It was founded earlier this year, and the school provides workshops and courses in subjects like portrait painting, drawing without lines, marionette making, and a lot more. Slug writer Anna Goodell sat down with Dunn's founding member Alexandra Carl about the school and its programs.
So first, tell us about Dunn's and how did the school come about and what inspired you to help organize it?
We opened our doors on April Fool's Day of this year, and it was really just a couple of friends sitting around and having so a studio became available in the Rockwood Arts Building down in Sugar House. And I have a friend called Christina Lindsay, who's a performance artist who I know from teaching at the U, and we meet every once in a while, and we had got together, and she mentioned that there was this studio that was available, and it just kind of developed out of a conversation about wanting to partner. There was my partner now, who is Gretchen Reynolds, my business partner, I should say. Desire to want to teach in the summers. You know, a lot of us were working during the school year, whether it was at the college level or at the school level, and we are all really passionate about art and about teaching art and talking about art and helping other people realize their inner artists. And so it was kind of like a confluence of lots of different opportunities that surfaced at the same time.
So what makes the Dunn's experience unique?
I think there are a lot of things that make it unique. I think the most obvious is the flexibility. We are a fast-acting entity. So if we hear of something that's interesting, so we do this thing called 12 Minutes Max, which sometimes happens once a month, sometimes happens every other month, but we try to feature about three artists. They can be poets or performance artists, or we've had singers, we've had jazz musicians, we've had buto dancing, we've had modern dancing, everything under the sun. And those 12 Minutes Max presentations really come together in a very short amount of time, and it's very exciting because sometimes we don't know from one month to the next what we're going to have, but the most amazing thing is that it always does come together, and we always have these wonderful people who do these wonderful things, and I don't know really how lucky we can be, but it's been really great so far. So I think the flexibility, and we also, another thing that we're starting to do is to host workshops by local educators. Gretchen and I really have had the experience that, you know, both of us have worked in academia. We know how difficult it is to, you know, when you're working in that setting, you get a lot of great ideas. You just, you know, you're with smart students, and you're reading all this great stuff and seeing all this great stuff, and it's inevitable that you have great ideas that, you know, you just think, oh, wouldn't it be great to teach this course? Wouldn't it be great to do a workshop on this subject? And it's really hard to get it done in the college environment because of the sort of bureaucratic overhead. Right. And so we've both tried that, and it's really quite challenging. There's always a kind of bottom line that a university or a larger campus requires, and we have a much, much smaller bottom line at Dunn's. And so we're able to, if educators do have just a sort of spontaneous idea about, hey, let's do a workshop on such and such, Dunn's can really pull it together in a short amount of time. And, you know, usually within a month, we can, through our website and through our Facebook page, we can get the word out, we can get people on board. And we just had a fantastic experience with John Erickson, who's a painter at the U, and we actually approached him about doing a painting or a drawing workshop, and it just came together marvelously. We had the participants were really thrilled, and John was really thrilled because of the flexibility. He got to try out some new ideas that maybe he wouldn't have otherwise been able to do in academia. And so we're hoping that that really takes off a bit more, and that we can offer that to local educators.
What do you consider the most difficult challenges of teaching adults? Because I know that dance is primarily adult education.
I guess I can only speak personally. I'm sure Gretchen would answer differently. My greatest challenge, I think, is that adults have much more fixed ideas about what art should be. It's as opposed to children, who are really, really open. They haven't learned that art has to represent something, or it has to be sharply defined, or it has to be framed, or it has to be painting and not, I don't know, like all the sort of conventions of art. Children haven't really learned that yet, but lots of adults can be kind of fixed in their tracks in terms of what art should be. And so sometimes, you know, teaching the more avant-garde subjects or the more avant-garde media can present a challenge. On the other hand, it can present an opportunity for a really great conversation, and I really love those conversations. So it's not all bad.
So what do you think is different about teaching art in Salt Lake versus other cities, and if it is different at all?
So I've lived in a couple of different countries, actually, and I've seen that in other countries, at least the ones that I have lived in, and so this isn't like a universal thing, it speaks more to the art scenes in Canada and in Germany and in England. Art is more of a, the visual arts, perhaps, even more generally, just the fine arts, it is more of a tradition in many other places. And what I mean by that is that particularly in Germany and in Canada, those societies really expect that there's going to be a certain sector of society that is pushing the boundaries and engaging the public in a certain way, which might not be easy. And there's a greater, I think, tolerance or curiosity for that kind of work. And I feel actually that there is not the same priority here that there is in those other places that I lived. Maybe that speaks more to my experience here, but I think I've seen some pretty radical things in Munich and in Ottawa and in Toronto and in London. And people are a bit more wary of artists, of people doing unconventional things here. And it's not welcomed necessarily with open arms, and it certainly isn't funded in the same way that that it is in other places. And I think that's a great loss.
About the Portrait Pebbles project, and I know this is a very unique project and a really dynamic way to think about the Holocaust and to humanize its victims.
It came about when I was working, I was teaching an art class at the Reform Synagogue called Kol Ami, and what I was doing generally was designing an art project for every Jewish holiday or Jewish major event, so New Year's or Yom Kippur or Passover and so on. And each year I was always, I don't know if I would say troubled or challenged by the prospect of what to do. There's a day in the year called Yom HaShoah, where, it's a day of remembrance for the victims of the Holocaust. And I was always kind of thinking loosely about what is an appropriate activity to do with kids. And I'm talking maybe like 8 and above or 10 and above. So youngish kids, not toddlers or anything. But what's an appropriate activity to do with them that would get them sort of thinking about some of the themes of the Holocaust. Part of my process in researching that was seeing what other people had done, the monuments around the world that commemorate the Holocaust, and, you know, what are the books and so on. And I guess I ended up designing this project which couples a person, not necessarily a child, can be an adult, anybody I think over the age of 10, with one of those photographs that was taken of the Jews when they were processed into concentration camps. You know, they were basically, as they entered, they had their heads shaved and their clothes were taken away. They were given one of those striped uniforms with a star on it, and then they were given a number and they were photographed. And these photographs still exist, and they're part of the there's a museum in Jerusalem, the Holocaust Museum, called the Yad Vashem Holocaust Museum, and which has a very extensive website with lots of resources for educators. So they have a database with a lot of these photographs, the sort of internment or processing photographs. They're almost like a passport photo. They're very kind of generic. And I got really interested in them because they're very, it doesn't take long. You know, you just have to look for a few moments to really see that you're looking at another person. You're not necessarily looking at a Jew or a prisoner or so on. You're looking at another person and the humanity, and, you know, some of them have been beaten up, they have black eyes, some of them, you know, have wounds, some of them, none of them are smiling, obviously. You know, you look at these pictures and you think, do they know they're going to die? Do they know what's going on? It's all, I just find them really evocative images. Anyways, I had this idea of having people try and do a little portrait, coupling a person with this photo and having them do a little portrait of the person on a stone, and then placing the stone in the Price Family Holocaust Memorial up at the JCC. I guess I had a lot of different motivations. Another motivation for me was the challenge, particularly for younger people, of kind of forcing them to work with a black and white photograph. I think that's such a difficult medium for today's generation, who are so used to moving images and video and streaming and everything that's so instantaneous that it's really hard to slow down and just look at a fixed image of another person. So I think that was a part of conceiving the project. And so that's what's been going on, and I think we've done several hundred little pebbles. They're all documented on the website, which is portraitpebbles.com. And it's been a terrific project to take into classrooms. You know, not everybody can make it up to the JCC, but I've had really, I would say, important conversations in classrooms. You wouldn't believe how many kids have never even heard this word, Holocaust. Never heard the word genocide, never heard of Rwanda. You know, I talk about other genocides as well as the Holocaust. And so I feel like I'm having really important conversations with people and with children, just about, you know, understanding the past, understanding what has gone on before. And I guess I should say another important component of it is that I would say maybe 2/3 of the project has to do with remembering those who perished. And the other third is about learning about tolerance and the importance of tolerance. And so the website has a list of quotes by famous people, you know, Martin Luther King, Kofi Annan, Gene Roddenberry, all kinds of people who have said something, Helen Keller is another one, who've said something interesting about the importance or the challenge of tolerance. So that's the last kind of component that I do in a classroom setting, is to talk about those quotes and try to get to the heart of what they mean and why it's important for us to tolerate each other and be kind to each other, and obviously what happens when things get out of control.
Dunn School for the Arts is located at 1062 East, 2100 South in Sugar House. For more information on the school, visit them online at dunceart.com. This is your weekly daily calendar of all the wonderful events that you can find listed at slugmag.com on a daily basis. You want to check back every day and make sure if there's something new popping in there. These are the events for December 18th to the 24th, and we start with, one that's going to be a love-hate thing for a lot of you listeners out there. Zappa Plays Zappa. Now, myself, I've never been a huge Frank Zappa guy, but I have friends who live and die for Frank Zappa. This is a show that his son, Dweezil, noted guitar player on Don Johnson's album Heartbeat from way back when. That's some good trivia for you kids out there. He's going to be playing his dad's music, songs like Chunga's Revenge, Dumb All Over, Cosmic Debris, and of course Muffin Man. This has become a really popular project for Dweezil Zappa because Frank has so many fans out there that just can't let him go, even though he's been dead for almost 20 years. But so it goes, right? There's a lot of dead bands out there too. Also on Tuesday the 18th, Plan B Radio Hour does one of its awesome Radio Hour presentations of Sherlock Holmes and the Blue Carbuncle. This is a world premiere by local playwright Matthew Ivan Bennett. It can get tricky to get tickets for these things, but it's worth doing if you can find some, and a lot of times they'll release tickets the day of the show. They're doing two performances at 7 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. at the Rose Wagner, and if you've never had a chance to check it out, it's totally worth it. You can hear it on the radio. They'll be playing it on KUER, but if you're there in person, you get to watch all the follow artists doing the sound effects in the back of voice actors. Usually it's Bill Allred from X96, Doug Fabrizio from KUER, and a couple of local actors. Really curious to see what Matthew Ivan Bennett does with this. He's done some really cool shows in the past as a writer, so this should be a great time. That is the Plan B Radio Hour at the Rose Wagner. On Wednesday, December 19th, Jesus or Genome, the project of Michael Kundik, who many of you will know from the band Loom. He is playing at Poplar Street Pub, kicking it in the corner. Good place to see him. Thursday, December 20th, a band called Rhythm Combo, local group led by John Grip, does a lot of that retro, old-school, twangy stuff. They're playing at the Tin Angel, so you can go get some tasty grub, hear some kickback rockabilly, a little bit of hillbilly music, some old-time country blues, that stuff, I just eat it up. Another thing that falls right in there, on Friday, December 21st, Wayne the Train Hancock, one of the baddest guitar players you'll ever find, great songwriter as well. He's playing at Bert's Tiki Lounge on the 21st with Utah County Swillers opening up. That'll be a great show. Across town, the one and only Snoop Dogg, who I could have sworn was going to change his name to Snoop Lion when he went all reggae this year, but apparently this end of the world party thing he's doing on 1221, it's still Snoop Dogg. He's actually a really great live performer when he has a live band with him. When he has a DJ with him, it can be a little more dicey. I'm not sure what he's doing, but I would imagine since it's an end of the world tour, he'll bring a real band with him, so it's got potential to be a great show. Saturday the 22nd, you can see Tough Titty at Burt's, rocking out some of that old school punk rock and roll, locals that have been around a long time. And look around downtown, the Santa Pub Crawl will be going on. There'll be little Santas all over downtown. So if you like that sort of thing, join the fun, get a Santa suit and go out there. If you don't, you might want to avoid downtown Salt Lake City on the 22nd. Go to slugmag.com, check out events every day, and if you want to submit your own, it's free to do on there. You can also add some bonus content for a mere $5 a month or $50 a year for your listings, so be sure to check that out. Desert Noises are a fine indie rock band out of Provo, and they've been touring quite a bit since they released their debut full-length called Mountain Sea last year in October, and they've had a pair of short U.S. tours, most recently wrapping up just last week with a show in Colorado Springs. The band recently released a brand new 3-track EP titled I Won't See You just last November. Here's the title track from that EP, I Won't See You. Thank you. For more information on Desert Noises, visit them online at desertnoisesmusic.com. Just 2 years ago, in 2010, the Utah Arts Alliance launched its Connect series. That's a time when once a month, local artists can bring in between 1 to 3 pieces that they're working on to showcase in a room full of fellow artists who will talk about the art and critique each other's work. It's like a writing circle, but for visual artists. Pretty cool idea. The events give the artists an opportunity to get feedback as they're working on things and a chance to attend lectures from advanced artists in the medium. Slug writer Rebecca Frost sat down in the Soundwave studio with Connect manager Michael Christensen and photographer Kat Paul about the events.
What was the inspiration for Connect?
I think the inspiration, it came from a multitude of places. It was actually an idea that I had a couple of years back. It was also an idea that Derek had had at a similar time, so it came together at kind of the same point in time. To be honest, I never really thought about it. The idea just came from the need that I think a lot of beginning artists have, that there is a huge gap between professional artistry and prestigious artistry and just starting out. And so Connect was the initial program that's going to help artists kind of bridge that gap between trying to be professional and just having somewhere to go. Because there's no process of getting in, you just show up the day of, deposit your work, and then vote, and then you leave. So there's no long list of things you got to do to get in there.
And so how difficult was it to get started?
So like I said, we started it in March 2011, and I had done a fundraiser in the previous fall that was basically the same program where people would bring in art and they would vote for their favorite pieces. And so the biggest hurdle that I hit there was that I didn't know anybody, and so there's only 3 people that showed up, and it was my father, my mother, and my high school art teacher. So that was a dang failure. So that the biggest hurdle was trying to get people to know that it exists, and that continues to be the largest hurdle. But since working with Derek and using his contacts, we were able to get the numbers up substantially from the 3 that had been there. So.
Well, awesome. That actually is my next question. How do you get information out to artists who might be interested in participating?
Well, it's right now I think our primary resources are the MailChimp mailing list, and that's just been artist names that we've been accumulating over the years. So yeah, through Facebook, word of mouth, I think other connections have come through. Our friend Kat Palmer here has done quite a mountainous effort to try to get the word out for us.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So how many artists usually participate?
I think in the 2011 to 2012 year, the least amount that we ever had was 30. In this year, it's kind of fluctuated a bit more. We've had more regularly, I think, between 25 and 40 in that area.
Wow.
And a lot of these people are people who've never been before, so that's really exciting for us. I mean, we of course, we're establishing kind of some momentum. We have reoccurring people. Yeah, a lot of people just new coming out to see it.
What is the most unique medium or theme that you have seen?
I'm pretty jaded when it comes to things like that. I mean,
crocheted lingerie.
Yeah. It was crocheted lingerie. That's right.
Wow.
Yeah. That was pretty unique.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really
some
cool.
Controversy over that one.
How do you decide on your guest speakers and guest artists?
That is a healthy balance between us needing to have someone and taking whoever we can get, and also...
That is not true. We do not take whoever we
no,
can get.
No, I'm kidding. And mostly it's Kat Palmer, who basically knows every artist in Salt Lake City. She helps us to schedule those artists. And a lot of them, the year prior, were people that Derek knew.
Yeah.
I don't know any artists.
What do you hope that some of the newer artists that come, what do you hope that they can learn from these guest speakers that you guys bring in?
I think the biggest thing I'd like them to learn is perseverance. I think it's been pretty consistent that the people that we've invited have been people who are doing this either professionally or on a much more serious basis than perhaps some of the newcomers there. So I'd like the audience, I mean, besides, like, you know, practical, like for example, if we had a guest painter, it'd be great if they learned how to paint. But that seems to me ultimately kind of secondary to just being among their peers who are persevering through things. I think that's my personal preference. I think other people would have different preferences, but that's what I would prefer.
Great.
I think also, too, depending on the guest speaker that we have, for example, recently we had Cheryl, the director of Art Access, come out and talk to the artists about the do's and don'ts of applying to galleries. And so it really gave artists a very good insight of what they need to do to be applying themselves professionally in the gallery world of things.
Connections are made, or do you hope are made, between all of the artists who attend?
Professional relationships, interpersonal relationships. I think there was one individual, mm-hmm. two individuals, I guess, it takes two to tango, who have gotten kind of a relationship.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I don't think boyfriend and girlfriend. We'll leave their names out of this,
but... I don't think it lasted too long, but it was still pretty encouraging.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, professional relationships, I think that's a pretty good cover-all.
I personally like meeting other artists. That are doing this, that are just emerging. I really enjoy that. So,
yeah,
that's great. It sounds like a really good networking opportunity.
Yeah, we're working on it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what people come to do. Yeah. Is they come and network and get to know one another and ask questions, and it's really good.
So. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of other features that we have available, but networking is the biggest one that we're pushing.
So at the end of the night, artists can vote on their favorite pieces of the evening, and winners can even win grants.
Right.
Can you describe that process?
Right now, it'd be nice to expand in the future, but we'll put that out of our minds, so sorry for bringing it up. What we do is we, throughout the night, we have artists setting up and getting numbers to each one of their pieces that correlate to, you know, numbers on a ballot, and then we have, throughout the evening, people just voting for their favorite three. And then at the end of the year, we have kind of a showcase of this peer-selected art, and the art basically qualifies for grant money by who has obtained the most popular vote throughout the entire season. Throughout the entire year, rather, as well as who gets the popular vote on the night of. So yeah, it's just popular vote throughout the year, as well as on the night of at the December Connect.
And they win a grant?
Mm-hmm. And the $2,000 is split between three people.
Wow.
I don't do the math because I'm an artist. So.
So what does that grant do for the artists who do win?
Well, I think we're pretty liberal about that. I guess they could, you know, go do some heroin with it if they wanted to, but I guess we would rather that they, you know, do, you know, buy art supplies and things like that, and if they had rent that they were, you know, at a studio that they were working at, that'd be nice that they put money towards that.
Do you have a success story from someone who's won in the past?
The success story is just kind of, I mean, there's plenty of success stories. I mean, I hope I don't embarrass one individual for bringing this up, but not necessarily for grants. I mean, you know, money is great. I think that it only goes so far. I think my personal favorite success story happens to be with a friend of the Arts Alliance. His name is Nick Farron. And he has a massive, I guess it's like a 4-foot by 6-foot huge installation, and it's something that's very cumbersome, something that would have been very hard to show anyone. He just had it hanging on his wall, and one night we had, like Kat was saying, a guest speaker from Art Access, and she gave him critique on it, and he just was really invigorated by her response. I mean, because here was, you know, this was his just kind of attempt to test the waters out, and he had actually, in the first attempt at doing that, was able to get it viewed by a gallery director who was quite enthusiastic about his work. So that is more along the lines of a success story that I'm personally interested in. I mean,
and now he has all these plans, and it's just amazing. And 4 feet by 6 feet doesn't sound really huge, but you have to realize there's 4,000 squares that have been hand painted on this piece, and so it's super heavy, and it's not just hung on a wall; it's bracketed to the wall.
Right. Yeah.
And
it's big.
And so, yeah, so it's really neat because I've seen his plans that he's working on now, and he's just so motivated and he has all these ideas that he's implementing, and I can't wait to see his finished pieces.
Yeah.
So,
like I said, there's only so much you can do with money. We'd like to see, you know, the grant go up so that we might be more enticing for more artists. But ultimately, the success stories are really just the more wholesome ones for me. Really, that's what I'm doing it for.
That's great. Lastly, what would you say to artists who might be nervous to have their art presented and even peer reviewed?
Well, I think to them I would say that if you are going to do it at all, I think Connect is probably the place you want to do it. I think for them I would also say that if you were that nervous, just show up, don't bring art, just show up, see what's there. If you want to show art, don't necessarily enter it into voting. You don't have to vote for it, you don't have to get it critiqued. Just show up, get your stuff out there, get you out there is the biggest thing I would encourage. Just see what's out there. No one's going to laugh at you. It's all a good place to be. I think it's about as down-to-earth as you can get, really, in the art world, because there's no not belonging, hopefully. That's what we're working towards.
Oh, cool. So.
The Utah Arts Alliance Connect will be taking January off, but will resume in February on the 8th at Salt Lake City Arts Hub, located at 663 West 100 South in downtown Salt Lake City. For more information on the Connect events and the Arts Hub, visit them online at utaharts.org. As always, thank you for listening to the Soundwaves from the Underground podcast. For all things Slug Magazine, visit slugmag.com. The year is quickly coming to an end, and a lot of people are putting dieting onto their agenda with their New Year's resolutions. We'll be talking to Jeffrey Stedman from Yelp about healthy places to eat out, and we'd like to hear your suggestions as well. You can either send them via email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. That line is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Give us a good suggestion, we just might play you on the show. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and produced by Gavin Sheehan. Associate producers are Esther Moronio, Ricky Vigil, and Alexander Ortega, and myself, Dan Nalen. The executive producer is Angela H. Brown. The theme music, performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. The main logo and art design is by T. Doan and technical design by Kate Colgan. Next week, an episode you will not want to miss when the all-star staff of Slug Magazine will be talking about all of their favorite local music from 2012. Be sure to tune in.